On a lonely stretch of highway in British Columbia, Canada, a sign warns travelers, girls, don't hitchhike on the Highway of Tears. There's a killer on the loose. Since 1970, a 720-kilometer or approximately 450-mile span of road that connects the towns of Prince George and Prince Rupert, officially known as Highway 16, has been the final resting place of an overwhelming number of victims, mostly women of Indigenous descent. According to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the victims number fewer than 18, but Indigenous organizations estimate the number of missing and murdered women above 40. Why is Highway 16 such a hub for abduction and murder? And will the victims of Highway 16 ever get justice? Join me tonight for episode 62 as we travel down Canada's infamous Highway of Tears.
Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club podcast. I'm Brandon.
I'm Ro.
And Derek is out haunting the streets of West Hollywood tonight. He will be back for our next episode. And as you could tell from the intro, it's Rowena tonight, and I think she's ready to start her story.
Hey, everyone. On tonight's episode, I'm taking a trip through British Columbia, Canada. We are going down the dark, dark rabbit hole known as the Highway of Tears. So let me start with some logistics and geography here. The Highway of Tears is officially known as Highway Number 16. It is about 450 miles or 720 kilometers long and runs from the town of Prince George to Prince Rupert in the British Columbia province of Canada. Now, this expansive highway is mostly remote and isolated with dense forests. Cell service, from what I've gathered on various source sites and social media posts, is sparse, as is access to public transportation, emergency call boxes, and lighting alongside the road is non-existent. According to Wikipedia, the Highway of Tears earned its ominous nickname when a lady named Florence Naziel coined it in a 1998 vigil for victims in the town of Terrace in British Columbia. Florence says she was thinking of the victims' families crying over their loved ones. Now, this name can also spark memory in United States history, as it is similar to the infamous and cruel Trail of Tears, when many Indigenous tribes of the eastern United States were forced under inhumane and brutal conditions to walk nearly 2,200 miles or 3,540 kilometers, where thousands perished along the way. While the Highway of Tears is different from the Trail of Tears, there are some significant similarities. The key similarity being that the number of missing and dead are a large majority of tribal and First Nations women. Now, before I get into a few victim stories, I need to apologize for not covering them all. When I looked into this case online, every source that I went to had a list. Every list had a different amount of numbers. So what I did was I kind of cross-referenced everyone. And if two or more names were on each list, then I decided to add it. That to me, that seemed the fair thing to do. And it was also a productive way to spend time, because if I were to read off every name I came across, this would be a 6-hour podcast episode. The victims span from 1969 to as recent as August of 2021. And unfortunately, it is ever expanding. I encourage everyone listening to look up the victim lists on Wikipedia, as it seems to be the most up-to-date. And again, for time's sake, I just cross-referenced and cross-matched names, and I whittled it down to probably about 40, which I'm sure Brandon is like, oh my God. So here we go. So from 1969 to 1980, there are at least 10 victims connected to Highway 16. So we're going to start there. Gloria Moody, age 27, murdered October 1969. Micheline Paré, 18, murdered July 1970. Helen Claire Frost, 15, missing October 1970. Jean Virginia Sempare, 18, missing October 1971. Gail Ways, 19, murdered October 1973. Pamela Darlington, 19, murdered November 1973. Colleen McMillan, 16, murdered August 1974. Monica Ignace, 15, murdered December 1974. Mary Jane Hill, murdered March 1978. Monica Jack, age 12, murdered May 1978. And some of these names, like, I'm not just going to read a whole deadpan list of names. The names I am giving you, there are stories attached to them. So just bear with me here, guys. So from 1981 to 1982, three homicides occurred with Highway 16 as the common link. In 1981, Jean Mary or Jean-Marie, I'm not sure if she used the French pronunciation, but since Canada is bilingual, I thought I'd try to be inclusive, was found dead from gunshot wounds to the head. Later, a month later, 13-year-old Roswitha Fuchs-Bickler was found mutilated and stabbed to death in an area near where Jean-Marie Kovac had been found. 15-year-old Nina Marie Joseph was found in August 1982, stabbed, strangled, and slashed. It seems a serial killer was on the loose. And I am happy to say that serial killer was caught. Edward Dennis Isaac was convicted of manslaughter. June 1986, he was arrested in February of 86 and was convicted by the testimony of an ex-girlfriend who had helped him dispose of Nina Joseph's body. He was given life in prison with a chance of parole after 15 years. That parole was denied, so he's still in prison. When asked why he did it regarding Roswitha Fuchs-Bickler, he simply said he wanted to know what it felt like. In 1988, he was also charged with the 1981 murder of Jean-Marie Kovac. However, my personal opinion is that this may have been forced upon or maybe a false confession. I couldn't find in the sources how they came to the conclusion that he was also responsible for her murder. But Isaac's victims were young girls, and his method of killing involved mutilation and stabbing, while Jean-Marie was shot, and she was an adult woman in her 30s. So the victimology doesn't, unless it was a crime of opportunity, the victimology doesn't really fit for him. And I'm not trying to minimize anything by any means. It was just something I wondered. And I also wondered if maybe it was a case of screw it, he's already guilty of the other two, let's add this one. So her family stops hounding us and call it a day. Because as we've seen with many of these cases, that can be a common theme. He is still serving his sentence in prison, so I'm not going to complain whatsoever. Like, he did it. He killed those other two. He absolutely got what he deserved. So back to our list. We have Shelley Bascu. She's 16, went missing in 1983. Alberta Williams, murdered 1989. Cecilia Ann Nickel, 15, 1989. And just after Nickel went missing in 1989, her cousin Delphine Nickel went missing in 1990. A few years later, another cousin, Roberta Nickel, was murdered in the same area. So that's three girls from one family gone. So now as we get into the 1990s, and I've barely scratched the surface, but I feel it's important to list as many names as possible on the off chance that someone out there might know something or recognize someone. So after Delphine in 1990, we have Therese or Teresa, the names were different on all the different sources. Humphrey, 38, murdered February 93. Marnie Blanchard, 18, murdered March 1993. And with that grouping, we have another serial killer caught and convicted. Brian Arp was arrested October 1993 and convicted. He is still serving his life sentence. The 90s was a very busy decade because we also have Ramona Wilson, 16, murdered June 94. Roxanne Tiara, 15, murdered November 94. Alicia Germain, 15, murdered November 94. Lana Derrick, 19, missing October 95. Dina Brahm, 16, murdered November 99. And Monica McKay, 18, murdered December 1999, which will take us into the 2000s. So in June 2002, Nicole Hoare, 24, went missing. Nicole is one of the few Caucasian women that went missing on Highway 16. And this is important because prior to her murder, she's not been declared dead yet or murdered anyway. Prior to her disappearance, none of these disappearances or murders were talked about beyond that little town, like that little stretch of highway and those little towns and that little province. Like, it was just local news. Even though you have all these people going missing, seems like one a month at least for the last 30 years. And it didn't make news until the Caucasian girl disappeared.
What a surprise.
Right. And that is mentioned later. But it seems that because of her disappearance, it kind of, you know, it got all this media attention. It kind of, you know, it gets the attention. It gets the public outcry. It then, just like the Gabby Petito case going on, it spurred the public to kind of look into this and say, hey, what's going on? Which then got kind of a fire lit under police's, you know, behinds. And they started to open up an inquiry. And which I am going to talk about that later. But that inquiry was officially announced in 2005. And it actually made some headway in a few of these cases, as you'll find out here later. So after Nicole Hoare goes missing in June 2002, we have Mary Madeline George, 25, missing July 2005. Tamara Lynn Chapman, 22, missing September 2005. Alea Sarek Auger, 14, murdered February 2006. Beverly Warbick, 20, missing June 2007. Bonnie Joseph, 32, missing September 2007. Jill Stukenko, 35, murdered October 2009. Emily Rose McLean, 16, murdered April 2010. Natasha Lynn Montgomery, 23, murdered August 2010. Cynthia Moss, 35, murdered September 2010. Lauren Leslie, 15, murdered November 2010. Now, I hope you were paying attention because that last grouping from 2009 to 2010 was the work of yet another serial killer, which now makes it three official serial killers. So that's one serial killer per decade that has hit this highway. And in mentioning that this highway along that stretch, it's kind of like, you know, where we grew up, Brandon, where kind of like Route 2 and Route 35. And then you just have all these little, not towns necessarily, but groupings of houses and maybe a gas station or a convenience store. And then you have the main towns like, you know, Point Pleasant, New Haven, and that's it kind of thing.
And so there are all these people like hitchhiking, I guess. Is that
why? Yes, because they don't have public transportation.
Right.
there's a lot of poverty. You can't afford cars, so you're going to hitchhike to the places you need to get. And then also, a lot of these people, especially the women, because they didn't have access to cars and they couldn't get jobs in the bigger towns, they started doing what I like the term high-risk behavior work, sex work, and that type of thing, which makes you more vulnerable to being kidnapped or killed by a serial killer. So Cody Legbakov was arrested November 27th, 2010. He was initially just pulled over for like erratic driving on the highway. And police noted that his truck was just covered in blood. There was bloody clothing in his truck. And they're like, well, this is weird. This is like an unusual amount of blood. And so the Mountie, I love saying that, the Mountie, he asked him, he said, what's going on? Are you hurt? What's with all this blood? And he told the officer, quote, I beat a deer to death because I'm a redneck and that's what we do for fun. Mm-hmm. Well, the officer, smart guy that he was, noticed there was no dead deer in his truck. So he called for backup. They took him in. They questioned him. They found out that those items in his car covered in blood were women's items. So, you know, red flag there. They got a warrant. So they found DNA evidence linking him to the deaths of Cynthia Moss, Lauren Leslie, Jill Stukinko, and Natasha Montgomery. I mean, that's pretty significant. Like, and then if you go back to the dates of their deaths, he just about got one a month in 2010. Yeah.
Why was he driving around with blood all over the place?
He had just killed her, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Like it was a fresh kill. And he had just got like disposed of the body, but he hadn't cleaned anything up yet. The person's belongings in the car, I should mention, belonged to Lauren Leslie, who was 15 when she was murdered. He had actually met her and lured her away from online. So, you know, again, be aware of who your kids are talking to.
Oh, so this was later. People were probably hitchhiking less. So now the internet becomes a tool.
Right, yeah. So this was 2010. And then in the instance of Natasha Montgomery, DNA was found all over his apartment. They found her clothing. They found her blood on an axe belonging to him. Big red flag there. And he was linked through DNA to the deaths of Cynthia Moss, Lauren Leslie, Jill Stukinko, and Natasha Montgomery. So pretty prolific serial killer there. So Cynthia Moss's body has not been found. They have just found her DNA in his apartment, and her blood was on a hatchet that they believe was a murder weapon. So he is also still in prison. He was convicted life without parole, and he is still serving his time. He is also one of Canada's youngest serial killers ever convicted. He was only 20.
What?
Yeah. So he was.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so unusual, as we all know. Like, usually they don't strike, serial killers don't strike until at least the age of 24.
Yeah.
And that's a young serial killer.
Yeah. I mean, it was crazy. And he was pretty brutal. So that gets us up to the latter half of the 2000s and up until currently. So in this final grouping, we have Madison Scott, 20, missing, May 2011. Immaculate Basil, 26, missing, murdered, June 2013. Anita Thorne, 49, murdered or missing, November 2014. And with that, All I could find in the official reports is that she went missing, but the police believe her car had something to do with her murder, but they won't classify her as one or the other, if that. So it didn't make sense. So I just had to put murdered and missing. Roberta Sims, 55, missing May 2017. Francis Brown, 53, missing October 2018. Chantel Simpson, 34, a suspicious death, July 2018. Now, Chantel's death was listed as suspicious, but that's because the cause of death has not been made public. Like, that's the only official thing they're saying on her death, is that it was suspicious death. Jessica Patrick, 18, murdered September 2018. Cynthia Martin, 50, missing December 2018. Lauren Fabian, 69, missing October 2019. Crystal Chambers, 34, murdered August 2020. So up until summer of last year. And these are just the ones that are either unsolved or they were killed and left along the highway. In my research, and I'll have all these links up in the show notes so you can kind of deep dive into it. There was probably double that of instances where women were murdered in the little, I don't know if I should say towns, because like I just said, Brandon, where you and Derek and I grew up, it's not really towns. It's like a cluster of houses and farms and then a convenience store or a factory or something like that. So I didn't include them because it was solved pretty quickly and it didn't actually occur on the highway. It occurred, in the little outcroppings near the highway, I guess would be the right word to say, the outcroppings near there. So it could be anywhere from the 40 or so that I've listed to some people say it could be in the hundreds. So these were just a handful of victims, like I mentioned. So back to the serial killer thing. So while serial killers Brian Arp and Edward Isaac were convicted in the 1980s, police didn't focus on Highway 16 itself and its crime patterns until 1998. And that wasn't even like an official thing. It was just an unspoken rule, like, oh, it happened on Highway 16. Check and see if it fits with anything else. But it never went beyond that. It never made the papers. It never went national. The federal government didn't get involved. It just kind of stayed as a local, like, oh, we better go check out Highway 16 then, kind of issue. So in 2005, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police launched Project E-PANA. That's E-PANA, which focused exclusively on the Highway of Tears. Their objective was to see if the murders and disappearances were the work of a single killer or a multitude. Through Project E-PANA, incarcerated serial killer Bobby Jack Fowler was linked to three victims in the 1970s. Gail Wace, Pamela Darlington, and 16-year-old Colleen McMillan. Already deceased by the time the evidence came to light, Fowler was never charged, but his DNA links him to those murders. Fowler was only convicted of kidnapping in Oregon in 1996, but he is suspected of up to 20 other rapes and homicides in addition to the Highway 16 murders. His crimes span from the late 1960s to the mid-1990s. He is one sick individual, and because I'm wanting to focus on the victims of Highway 16, I didn't want to include too much about him because I don't want the focus to be on him. But, you know, certainly if serial killers are of your interest, he is one to look up for sure. He died in 2006 of lung cancer in the Oregon State Penitentiary. So just a year after the official inquiry opened up, he died. So had this opened up just a little bit earlier, they probably could have charged him. Project E-PANA was also able to link and convict Gary Taylor Handlin in the 1978 murder of 12-year-old Monica Jack. He was the first official case closed by EPANA with full court proceedings. Unfortunately, due to budget cuts, Project EPANA has dwindled from 70 officers in 2006 to 12 officers in 2010. So in researching this story, a big question came to light. As we began to understand serial killers in the 80s and 90s, and as police noted patterns and similarities in certain groups of victims, why wasn't an official task force set up until the early 2000s? And I touched on this a little bit earlier with you, Brandon, about Nicole Hoare. And a lot of people feel like that was a big catalyst, because before that, the majority of these victims were First Nations women, Indigenous women. And as we see a lot of times, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Caucasian women get the media coverage and the other women don't. It's really a shame, especially in a case like this where the victims could number up into the hundreds. So activists will argue that the lack of media coverage and the fact that the media assigned, quote, lesser value to Aboriginal women, end quote, means less public knowledge and therefore less public outcry to get these cases solved. Case in point, Nicole Hoare, a Caucasian woman who disappeared in 2002, received a disproportionate amount of media attention. Of all the cases since 1969, hers was the first to be covered nationally. Gladys Radek, Native activist and aunt of victim Tamara Chipman, believes that if it wasn't for Hoare's case, the police would have invested less effort in investigating and the media would have done little, if anything, to inform the public of the tragedies along this road. And I did notice, too, in my research, it is very hard. Like, I could not find any newspaper articles before 2005. Like, all these other crimes were mentioned, but nothing originated from the years before 2005. Not even just a blip of like girl goes missing. And that's really sad to me. Like the case you just did with the Freeway Phantom, is these girls are just not treated human, and it breaks my heart.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And we both have very timely episodes these past 2 weeks, and they both were, you know, recommended to us.
So why is the highway such a portal of doom? Numerous towns are what I like to call outcroppings, because they're not like official municipalities, and 23 First Nations communities. And I probably should have clarified this at the beginning for people who are not from North America. First Nations people, Indigenous, Aboriginal, those terms that I've been using through this whole episode, are terms that we use for the Native peoples of Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Just to clarify, the rural region is plagued with poverty and lacks public transportation. Many residents hitchhike as a form of transportation or turn to high risk behaviors, like I said earlier when we talked about it, sex work, to survive. In 2006, various Aboriginal groups convened for a 2-day symposium to make recommendations to the government on how to make their communities and Highway 16 safer. So this two-day symposium, they came up with a report that was issued with recommendations to improve public transit, deter hitchhiking, and prevent violence against Aboriginal women. The report was endorsed, but not until 2012. In 2016, the Minister of Transportation announced that as a result of the report, a bus transit would be available along Highway 16. It only took 10 years. That's government for you. The Highway of Tears has long been an urban legend within the local First Nations communities, one that unfortunately is truth rather than legend, used to frighten young people from walking the roads at night. The odds of solving all of these cases are slim, but as long as we keep shining light on these types of cases, the embers of hope may still yet keep burning. And I really believe that. I mean, somebody might recognize one of those names I just read out loud.
Yeah, there's more to this than being obsessed with true crime. You know, it can serve a purpose, and that's what we hope to do on top of, you know, entertaining people. Because, you know, let's face it, with every story we tell, there are families out there still looking for these people or looking for these answers. And sometimes it gets hard for us to look at this as, you know, a method of entertainment, because it is real life for a lot of people. And we understand that true crime fans are aware of that as well. But, you know, we do like to point out sometimes that there's a greater purpose here often.
But yeah, and it, you know, while this can be entertaining for everyone, and we hope that we entertain people, we want you to come back and keep listening, but we also hope that we help too, you know. And this is just one instance of hundreds and thousands of instances of an ignored section of people, marginalized people, who are not getting the same amount of coverage that they need to find their loved ones. And, you know, that's something that we're aware of and we are trying to be cognizant of. But also, there is a lack of resources when it comes to searching these cases. Like I said, these victims have been victims since 1969, which is the earliest documentation of that. I mean, it could have even go on before that. But I couldn't find anything about anyone prior to 2005. And, you know, that's a shame. And unfortunately, in a lot of these types of cases, it is hard to find up enough information to put out a report for people to learn about. You know, I hope the media and researchers and true crime writers and, you know, everyone involved in getting these cases out there starts to do a little more so that, you know, everybody gets a chance to have their story told.
For sure. So I do have a question, though. Was Nicole Hoare's killer ever caught? Or was, I mean, I guess she was considered, I guess she's still considered missing, actually. So,
yeah. So she has not been found as of today. They are still looking for her, and there is no suspects into her disappearance at this point. And that is the case for the majority of these. Like, we got three serial killers and one just random killer caught, but that's it out of all of these names. The rest of them remain unsolved to this day.
And what's really wild is you have to think that there were probably more serial killer victims in all those from 1969 on. There, like, three seemed like a lot, but there probably had been more.
I'm sure. And then, and this EPANA task force are really utilizing DNA. So I have a feeling, while I'm sure the ones from the 60s and 70s, you know, their killers are probably long gone at this point. You know, I'm sure more is going to come out as more offenders get put in the system. I feel like more DNA is going to get matched, and we're going to find a few more of these victims out there.
So another question that I had, and I know it's not the topic, but is it only women who were murdered along the highway or dumped along the highway? Did you ever find any stories of men?
There were. It seemed like when the EPANA investigation opened up, at first, they had, in the early 2000s, they had added three men to that list. But then they took those men off the list because they didn't meet some of the criteria. And that was, they had to have been found on the highway or abducted from the highway. So these men were either on the outskirts or in one of those outlying communities. There is, and I'll link it in here, there has been a documentary done on the Highway of Tears, and it was done by with the endorsement of the First Nations communities, where they are actually talking about their experience with it. And it's really good. You can actually go to their website and watch it. It's like $1 to rent. And I highly, highly recommend it. You can also rent it from YouTube, but it's $1.99. So I would rather go straight to the source where they get the money. And then, and that was probably the best documentary source for this. And then another one of my sources that I really liked for this was a retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police detective. He's a true crime writer now, and he has a whole blog dedicated to the Highway of Tears, where he breaks it down a lot better than I ever could have. And he makes everything very, you know, in the way that a detective would do. It's very precise, very orderly, lots of lists, lots of graphics, lots of maps, if you're interested in that sort of thing. And I'll put the link for that in there too.
So I really wonder what it is with this highway. I mean, I know, you know, you've explained it and I've read explanations about it, but what the fuck is really going on there? You know, it's like, how is it so deadly? Like,
I know it. And, you know, and when you look at it, I mean, it looks like something out of Unsolved Mysteries, like straight out of Unsolved Mysteries. It is just like a stretch of road, but it looks like it was just like carved straight through the woods and the mountains. Like, until you zoom in on it, like, that's all you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it gives you a creepy feeling just looking at pictures of it.
Yeah, I guess more than anything, it was a dumping ground, or maybe not more than anything, but it was also a dumping ground for people murdered elsewhere. And it's because it was isolated and easy to just, you know, toss out a body, I guess.
Yeah. It seemed like it was equal parts abduction site and dumping ground. And that does lead into another crime against a lot of Indigenous women, especially if you're really into true crime and you're listening to the blotters and the different blogs, you'll notice there is an epidemic of Native women being trafficked. And I feel like, especially in these later years, that probably has a lot to do with it too, especially if you look at some of the ages of these women and girls that have been abducted.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because, like we already covered, you know, a lot of those people probably weren't hitchhiking. You know, hitchhiking was kind of left with the 80s, I think, 80s and 90s.
Yeah. And then probably the late 90s in the more, you know, rural mountain areas where like this is. But yeah, by the 2000s, definitely it feels like it would be less of a thing. Like, you could carpool easier.
Yeah.
Or catch a ride, or call and catch a ride with someone you knew easier.
Right now, there's officially a bus, right? A bus line?
Yes. As of 2018, they were putting in a bus line. And as of this year, they're working on getting cellular service on the highway.
Nice.
Which I think will help a lot.
For sure.
And the big sign, which I emailed to you, it's a big billboard, and it's bright yellow, and you can't miss it. And it just says, "Don't hitchhike here." Like, that says it all. Like, it just is just a big ominous warning that kind of sets the tone for the whole drive, I feel.
For sure. Maybe he can call an Uber instead.
Yeah. But that does it for my episode today, everyone. Hope you found it informative, and I hope you stuck with us through it all. And if you want to know more about it or any of our other cases, you can check us out on social media. We have a private Facebook group. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. You can always email us. You can check out our website, 3ammysteryclub.com. And as of now, we have a new and improved merch store where you can buy some really cute things for the holidays if you celebrate them. We have some I'm really proud of the puzzle that we designed. That's probably my favorite thing in the merch store now, next to the fanny pack. It's the puzzle.
Oh, yes. The fanny pack, though, that's hard to top, but the puzzle comes close.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, my mom, so far, is the exclusive only owner of the fanny pack.